Hitler's War by David Irving. Goddess of Fortune. Hitler had returned to the Berghof, high above the little alpine town of Berchtesgaden, early on February 6th, 1938. It was here that he always came when he had to ponder the path ahead. Ever since he had first been driven up the rough mountain paths on the pillion seat of a motorbike, he had been in love with this Obersalzberg mountainside. A green ridge straddling lakes and pine forests, velvet pastures and dairy herds. Here in the late 1920s, he had purchased a cottage with the royalties earned by Mein Kampf and articles published under a pseudonym by the Hearst Press and the New York Times in America. Around this cottage, he had built his Berghof. The air up here was clean and pure. Quote, "Fresh air is the finest form of nourishment," unquote, he would say. Rudolf Hess, his deputy, described Hitler's everyday routine at Berghof in a long letter to his mother, dated January 15, 1938. Quote, "On his rest days up there, the Führer likes to stay up far into the night. He watches a film, then chats, mostly about naval things, if I'm there, as they interest us both, then reads a while. It's morning before he goes to sleep. At least he doesn't ask to be woken up until 1 or 2 p.m. In contrast to Berlin, where he doesn't get to bed any earlier, but is up again only four or five hours later. After a communal lunch, he and his guests usually take a stroll of half an hour or more to a tea pavilion built a year ago with a magnificent view over Salzburg. It's really cozy sitting at the big open fire at a large circular table, which just about fills the equally round building. The illumination is provided by candles and holders around the walls. Heinrich Hoffmann, Hitler's photographer, and his missus are usually there. He plays the part of the court jester. There's always one of the Führer's doctors, Dr. Karl Brandt or Dr. Werner Hasse, as well as the press chief, Dr. Otto Dietrich, adjutants Wilhelm Bruckner, Julius Schaub, or Fritz Wiedemann, often Sophie Stork, whom you know is up there with Evie Braun and her sister Gretel, and sometimes Dr. Theo Morell with his wife Joanna and Professor Albert Speer. Speer is usually up there when the new buildings are being planned. After 1 or 2 hours up there, we walk for about 10 minutes to a group of cross-country vehicles waiting to drive us back down." End quote. Hitler appointed Martin Bormann, Hess's chief of staff, to manage the Berghof. It was a position that gradually gave Bormann control over Hitler's household, too. A former estate manager from Mecklenburg, Bormann was a hard worker and took care that Hitler knew it. He would telephone for a routine invitation to Hitler's luncheon table, then cancel it, quote, "because of the pressure of work," unquote. To the slothful and pleasure-loving soldiers and bureaucrats, his love of hard work made Bormann a thoroughly loathsome creature. Quote, "Since 1933, I've worked like a horse," he wrote to party officials after Hess's strange defection in 1941. "Nay, more than a horse, because a horse gets its Sunday and rests at night," end quote. Hitler's word was Bormann's command. Bormann bought up the adjacent plots of land to preserve the Berghof's privacy. Once Hitler mentioned that a farmstead spoiled his view. When he next looked, it had vanished and the site was leveled and freshly turfed. On June 13, 1937, a Sunday, Bormann noted in his diary, quote, "Because of the heat of high summer, the Führer wished there were a tree where the daily march past occurs. I have ordered a tree from Munich," unquote. The lime tree was erected 4 days later. Thousands flocked daily to the Berghof to see Hitler in the flesh. Quote, "The Führer is up there at the Obersalzberg now," unquote, wrote his Autobahn architect Fritz Tott to a friend. Quote, "On days when he has nothing particular to do, he permits anybody who wants to come past to his garden after lunch at about 2 or 3 p.m., and he waves to them. It's always a very gay procession up there on the Obersalzberg. The folks walk past quietly saluting, and they mustn't shout or anything. Only the children are allowed to hop over to the Führer, unquote. The main feature of the rebuilt Berghof was the Great Hall, a room over 60 feet long. One entire wall was a panorama window. unprepared visitors walking into the Great Hall gained the momentary, eerie notion that they were looking at an unusually vivid green drapery until their eyes refocused to infinity and the distant shapes of the trees of the Untersberg mountain were seen. From the quarries of the Untersberg would later be hewn the red marble slabs with which Hitler would rebuild his Berlin Chancellery. Legend had it that in that mountain lay the medieval Emperor Barbarossa, that he would lie there for 1,000 years, and that one day he would return when Germany most needed him. In the Great Hall there was an overlong table, surfaced with a red marble slab from across the valley. On it, each morning, the adjutant spread out the mail, the newspapers, and the latest dispatches from Berlin. On this same marble slab were later unfolded the maps of Europe and charts of the world's oceans. One 1940 photograph shows the Führer leaning on the maps, surrounded by generals and adjutants. The potted plants have been pushed to the far end of the table, and Schmunt has casually laid his leather document pouch amongst them. Alfred Jodl, Wehrmacht Chief of Operations, is standing expressionlessly with folded arms in front of a rich tapestry. On the back of the snapshot, Jodl himself has penciled, quote, July 31st, 1940, up at the Berghof. The Führer is enlarging on a decision taken shortly before, and it's a good thing that the maps can't be recognized, unquote. The maps are of the Soviet Union. Days in the Berghof passed with a monotonous sameness. The thick-walled building shrouded in a cathedral-like silence, punctuated by the yapping of two Scottish terriers owned by a young woman living anonymously upstairs, or by the laughter of an adjutant's children. Hitler himself slept all morning, while the servants silently cleaned the paneling or dusted the works of art, here a Tintoretto or a Tipolo, there a small Schwint. Lunch was presided over by Hitler. With the young woman on his left, the talk revolved around film, theater, or fashion. The meals, however, were, of Puritan simplicity. Earlier in his life, Hitler had eaten meat, but he had suddenly pronounced himself a vegetarian after a suicide tragedy in his town apartment in Munich, 1931, a fad for which he later offered various excuses, quote, that he had noticed body odors when he ate meat, or that the human jaw was designed for vegetarian meals. Hitler regaled his Berghof diners with unappetizing detail of various processes he had observed in a slaughterhouse, and all the distracting endeavors of the young woman at his side failed to stop him from inflicting this on each new unsuspecting visitor to the Berghof. After supper, the tapestries in the Great Hall were drawn back and a movie film was shown. Hitler followed this practice nightly until Europe dissolved into war at his command. His appetite for movies was prodigious, but Bormann efficiently submitted weekly lists to the propaganda ministry and asked for certain regular favorites like The Hound of the Baskervilles and Mutiny on the Bounty to be permanently available at the Berghof for the Führer's entertainment. It was here at the Berghof that Hitler proposed to stage his next coup. A conference with the Austrian Chancellor, Kurt Schuschnigg. Relations with Austria were formally governed by a treaty of July 1936. Schuschnigg was autocratic and willful and refused to accept the harsh realities of Central European politics. To his friend, the police president of Vienna, he once admitted that Austria's future was, quote, of course, unquote, inseparable from Germany's, but he was damned if he was going to put up with Berlin dictating his own foreign policy to him. Such a meeting with Hitler had long been Schuschnigg's dream. He would talk to the Reich Chancellor, quote unquote, man to man, he said. Hitler was initially only lukewarm, but he had told his special ambassador in Vienna, Franz von Papen, in the first week in January that the meeting might take place at the end of the month. On the 11th, at Hitler's New Year diplomatic reception, François Poncet happened to express a hope that 1938 would not be seeing any of Hitler's, quote, Saturday surprises, unquote. to which the Nazi foreign minister Neurath replied that the internal situation in Austria did give cause for concern. Over dinner with the Austrian envoy, Stefan Tauschitz, on January 21st, Neurath amplified this, quote, "If a boiler is kept heating and there is no safety valve, it's bound to explode," unquote. This was a reference to the continued internment of Austrian Nazis, against the spirit of the July 1936 treaty. On the 22nd, Vienna learned from Berlin that Goering was secretly boasting that the Reich's difficulties in paying cash for Austrian raw materials would disappear in the spring. On January 26th, the very day of the confrontation staged in Hitler's library between General von Fritsch and the blackmailer, Neurath telegraphed from Berlin to Vienna the Führer's proposal that the Berghof meeting should take place on about February 15th. 5 days later, Alfred Jodl's diary quoted Keitel, quote, "The Führer wants to switch the spotlight away from the Wehrmacht, make Europe catch its breath. Schuschnigg had better not take heart, but tremble," unquote. 2 days later, on February 2nd, 1938, Hitler walked across the Chancellery Garden to the Foreign Ministry and appointed Joachim von Ribbentrop as the new Foreign Minister in place of Neurath. He had already told Goebbels of his intention 2 weeks before. Goebbels warned him that Ribbentrop was a, quote, zero, unquote, but Hitler saw in him the ideal diplomatic secretary, a loyal henchman who would channel his political directives to the missions abroad. Ribbentrop had few other admirers. One voice, that of an army general, Karl Heinrich von Stulpnagel, summarized the main objections to him. Quote, "Indescribably vain. His idea of foreign policy is this. Hitler gives him a drum and tells him to bang it, so he bangs the drum loud and strong. After a while, Hitler takes the drum away and hands him a trumpet, and he just blows that trumpet until he's told to stop and play a flute instead. That's why he's been banging and tooting and fluting. He never knows and never finds out." End quote. Ribbentrop was 4 years younger than Hitler. He had served as an officer in a good Prussian regiment. In post-war years, he had built up a thriving export-import business in wines and spirits. With his increasing affluence, he had bought a villa in Berlin's fashionable Dahlem suburb and married into the Henkel Champagne family. Hitler regarded this rich newcomer as somebody with influential connections abroad. There is no doubt that he had selected Ribbentrop until now. Until now, his London ambassador, to replace Neurath in forlorn hope that this would flatter opinion in the British capital. He apparently disclosed to him only his more immediate geographical ambitions. Austria, Czechoslovakia, the former German province of Memel, seized by Lithuania in 1923, Danzig, and the quote-unquote Polish Corridor, the strip of land linking Poland to the Baltic but separating East Prussia from the rest of Germany. Ribbentrop, for his part, respected Hitler's confidences. He was a gentleman with a sense of the correct that sometimes inflated to almost ludicrous proportions. He would decline to discuss with post-war American investigators the details of his August 1939 secret pact with Stalin, since it was still secret, quote, "as a matter of international courtesy," unquote. Franz von Papen, Hitler's special envoy to Vienna since 1934, arrived at the Berghof late on February 6, 1938, shortly after Hitler himself. Hitler had recalled him, but now promptly sent him back to Vienna with instructions to invite the Austrian Chancellor to the Berghof on the 12th. Papen pocketed his pride and did so over the next few days. He and Schuschnigg discussed that demands each... Sorry. Over the next few days, he and Schuschnigg discussed what demands each side had to make of the other. Schuschnigg agreed in principle to appoint pro-German ministers of finance and security. Hitler agreed to close down the Nazis' headquarters in Vienna. For this summit meeting, Hitler set his stage with the care of a Bayreuth producer. The guard barracks on the approach road to the Berghof were filled with quote-unquote Austrian Legion units. There were 120,000 men in the Legion, outnumbering Austria's legal army 2-1. The SS sentry manning the gate on the final approach growled in unmistakable Corinthian dialect, and as Hitler marched down the steps to meet the half-tracked vehicle bringing Schuschnigg's little group up the ice-bound lanes, he was accompanied by Reichenau and Luftwaffe General Hugo Spurl, quote, "my two most brutal-looking generals," unquote, he later chuckled to his adjutants. He boasted to Goebbels afterwards that he had used, quote, pretty tough, unquote, language to the Austrian chancellor and had threatened to use force to get his way, saying, quote, "guns speak louder than words," unquote. The Austrian made a bad impression on the prudish Führer. He remarked to his staff that Schuschnigg had not shaved and his fingernails were dirty. The atmosphere of their talks was well illustrated by Hitler's own May 1942 recollection, quote, "I won't ever forget how Schuschnigg shriveled up when I told him to get rid of those silly little barricades facing our frontier, as otherwise I was going to send in a couple of engineer battalions to clear them up for him," unquote. Hitler said he had decided to solve the Austrian problem so oder so. His advisors had submitted an alternative, less martial plan to an alternative less martial plan to him. Schuschnigg must sign it too. Quote, "This is the first time in my life I have ever changed my mind," unquote, Hitler said. Schuschnigg put up a stout fight despite the blatant intimidation tactics. Over lunch, Hitler's generals loudly discoursed on the Luftwaffe and its new bombs, and Hitler talked about his Panzer armies of the future. Schuschnigg poked at his food without appetite. When Hitler subtly changed his tone and turned with enthusiasm to his plans to rebuild Hamburg with giant skyscrapers bigger than New York's, he sketched the giant bridge that he and Tott were going to throw across the River Elbe, the longest bridge in the world. Quote, "a tunnel would have been cheaper," he admitted. "I want Americans arriving in Europe to see for themselves, however, that anything they can do, we Germans can do better," end quote. He also announced that later in 1938, a new warship was to be launched with the name of Admiral Tegethoff, after the Austrian hero who had sunk the Italian fleet in the Battle of Lissa in 1866. Quote, "I'm going to invite both of you as Austrian Chancellor and Admiral Horthy to the ceremony," unquote, Hitler promised Schuschnigg. This generated such enthusiasm that when Hitler withdrew after lunch with Ribbentrop to draw up the document that Schuschnigg must sign, some of the Austrian visitors loudly proclaimed, quote-unquote, "Heil Hitler!" to everybody's embarrassment. This mood changed sharply when Schuschnigg saw the proposed agreement. It required him to appoint Dr. Arthur Seyss-Inquart as Minister of Security and Dr. Hans Fischbach as Minister of Finance to prepare an economic union between Austria and Germany. All imprisoned Nazis were to be amnestied and reinstated. Ribbentrop bluntly told Schuschnigg that these terms were not open to negotiation. A new battle began. It was a gentle process obtaining Schuschnigg's signature. At one point, Ribbentrop came in and complained, quote, "Mein Führer, I've reached agreement with him on every point except one. He won't appoint Seyss-Inquart as Minister of Security," unquote. Hitler retorted, quote, "Tell him that if he doesn't agree, I'll invade this very hour," unquote. This was a bluff. Schuschnigg was insisting on 6 days grace as only President Wilhelm Miklas could appoint new ministers. Hitler called him back to his study and resumed his bluster. Once he threatened, quote, "Do you want Austria to become another Spain?" unquote. Then he asked Schuschnigg to step outside, and as the door opened, he called out into the great hall, quote, "General Keitel!" When Keitel hurried in, Hitler motioned him to a chair. "Just sit there," unquote. This dumb charade lasted for 10 minutes before Schuschnigg was called back in. Schuschnigg initialed the final draft of the agreement without further objection. He had withstood Hitler's hypnotic influence for longer than many of the Wehrmacht's most seasoned generals later did. Quote, "I have to admit," Schuschnigg told a Viennese intimate 2 days later, "that there's something of the prophet about Hitler." Unquote. For all Hitler's tough talk, he had no intention of starting a forcible invasion of Austria, provided that Schuschnigg kept his part of the bargain. Hitler told his Luftwaffe adjutant that Austria would draw closer to the Reich of her own accord, perhaps that very autumn of 1938, unless Schuschnigg committed some Dummheit meantime. To deter Schuschnigg from second thoughts, however, he ordered the OKW to fake preparations for an invasion. Vice Admiral Wilhelm Canaris personally arranged this from his Abwehr's regional headquarters in Munich. At first, these fears seemed groundless. Shortly after Hitler's return to Berlin, he learned on February 15th that President Miklas had fully ratified the Berghof Agreement. Hitler was host to the diplomatic corps that evening. The Austrian envoy, Stefan Tauschitz, reported to Vienna afterward that congratulations were showered on him by Goering, Goebbels, and Hitler himself. Hitler told the diplomats that the, quote, age of misunderstandings, unquote, was over. It was not long before this tone changed, however. As though on a given signal, the British and French newspapers began printing lurid stories of Hitler's Berghof blackmail. Quote, the world's press rages, noted Goebbels, and speaks, not entirely unjustly, of rape, unquote. The upshot was that on February 18th, 1938, the German Air Force received its first ever provisional order from Goering to investigate possible operations against London and southern England in case war with Britain broke out. Ribbentrop's personal intelligence office, run by Rudolf Leikas, learned that once back in Vienna, Schuschnigg and Guido Schmidt had, quote, recovered their balance, unquote, and that they were working to sabotage the Berghof Agreement. Hitler adhered to it, sedulously, one might think. In his next Reichstag speech on February 20th, he praised Schuschnigg. Next day, he summoned the radical Austrian Nazi, Joseph Leopold, to Berlin and dismissed him. Hitler informed Leopold's successor that from now on there was to be a different approach toward Austria. To Ribbentrop and five Austrian Nazis on February 1938, he repeated that he had abandoned forever all thought of using force against Austria. Time, he said, was in his favor. On March 3rd, Hitler had received the new American Charge d'Affaires, Hugh R. Wilson. In a private letter to President Roosevelt, Wilson remarked upon the, quote, lack of drama in this exceedingly dramatic figure, unquote, and upon the formality of the occasion. When Wilson had met the ex-saddlemaker, President Friedrich Ebert, they had munched black bread and quaffed beer together, but Hitler now received him in a stiff dress suit. The Führer was healthier than Wilson had expected, more solid and erect, though pale. The character in the Führer's face, his fine artistic hands, his simplicity, directness, and modesty were the first impressions that Wilson conveyed to Roosevelt. The same day, March 3rd, saw the long-announced new British initiative. The offer was brought from London by the ambassador Sir Neville Henderson. Chamberlain himself had explained it to the Cabinet's Foreign Policy Committee on January 24th as a deal whereby Nazi Germany, quote, would be brought into the arrangement by becoming one of the African colonial powers, unquote. In return, Germany would be expected to limit her armaments and to recognize the status quo in Europe. Hitler listened to the ambassador's 10-minute speech with a scowl, then launched into a ferocious 30-minute reply. Nothing could be done until the current press campaign against him in England ceased. Nor was he going to tolerate the interference of third parties in Central Europe. He refused to consider unilaterally limiting armaments, so long as the Soviet Union's rearmament continued unchecked. Henderson patiently outlined the colonies offered on the globe in Hitler's study. Hitler asked what was so difficult about simply giving back the African colonies, quote-unquote, robbed from Germany after the World War. Hitler asked Ribbentrop to return to London to take formal leave as ambassador, an act of calculated blandishment, and instructed him to find out whether Chamberlain seriously desired Entente. Hope I'm saying that right. Hitler's more general instructions to him were reflected by Ribbentrop's remarks to Baron Ernst von Weizsäcker on March 5th, when he invited him to become his new state secretary. Ribbentrop talked of, quote, a grand program that cannot be accomplished without the sword. It will therefore take 3 or 4 more years before we are ready. Where exactly the fighting will be and wherefore is open to later discussion. If at all possible, Austria is to be finished off, liquidiert, before 1938 is out." End quote. In Berlin, Hitler found army opinion still unsettled by the creation of the OKW. There were sounds of distant thunder. The General Staff submitted its opinion on March 7, 1938. General Walter von Brauchitsch, Commander-in-Chief, signed the memorandum, which had been drafted by General Ludwig Beck, together with his deputy Erich von Manstein. Their proposal was that the army should have predominance in any Wehrmacht command. Viewed in the subsequent light of the World War waged largely by the strategic bomber and the submarine, Beck's memorandum was a dismal disappointment. In part, it gratuitously insulted Hitler. In bygone times, the document conceded any monarch could be a warlord if he chose. Friedrich the Great and Napoleon were examples. But now, quote-unquote, even a genius could not manage both political and military leadership. Beck rightly argued that there were 2 quite distinct functions in a war. The organization of the domestic war economy by a, quote, Reich Secretary for War, unquote, and the conduct of strategic operations by a, quote, Reich Chief of General Staff, unquote. Inasmuch as the balance of future wars would lie in the army's hands, clearly the army should provide that strategic leadership. Quote, the more there comes to the fore a war... Wait, let's start that over again. The more there comes to the fore in a war... Holy shit, this is a hard sentence to say. The more there comes to the fore a war in the East, which will be a matter of the conquest of territory, the more it becomes obvious that ultimately the success of the army will decide between the victory or defeat of the nation in that war. A further factor is that of our eastern enemies, Russia and Poland, cannot be mortally injured at sea or in the air, and even if Czechoslovakia's cities and industrial centers are destroyed, she can only be forced at most to surrender certain territories, but not to surrender her sovereignty completely. Unquote. I did it. The document argued that the Navy and Luftwaffe would be confined to primarily defensive roles to, quote, keeping the sea lanes open, unquote, and, quote, defense of the homeland, unquote. The possibilities of extended cruiser warfare of the submarine campaign, of operations like the seaborne invasion of Holland, of the bombardment of Belgrade and the destruction of the Polish, French, and Russian air forces were not even contemplated by Beck. Hitler told his adjutants that the document was calling for the precise opposite of what he had ordered on February 4th. Quote, if the army had had any say in it, he later reminded Major Rudolf Schmundt, the Rhineland would still not be free today, nor would we have introduced conscription, nor concluded the naval agreement, nor entered Austria, unquote. Quote, nor entered Austria, unquote. Toward midday on March 9, 1938, Hitler heard rumors that Schuschnigg was to spring a snap plebiscite on Austria's future. This was the Dummheit that Hitler had been waiting for. The plebiscite's one question had been so formulated that any Austrian voting, quote, unquote, no to it could be charged with high treason, since voters had to state their names and addresses on the ballot papers. Some of his ministers felt the voting age should be 18, with only his party members allowed to vote. Others recalled that the Constitution defined the voting age as 21, but Schuschnigg arbitrarily raised it for the plebiscite to 24, the Nazis being primarily a party of youth, and stipulated that the votes were to be handed to his own party officials, not the usual polling stations. Even if one of the printed yes ballot papers were to be crossed out and marked with a large no, it would still count as a yes. There were no ballot papers. Hitler flew his agent Kepler to Vienna with instructions to prevent the plebiscite, or failing that, to insist on a supplementary question sounding the Austrian public on its attitude toward union with the Reich. That evening, Schuschnigg formally announced the plebiscite. Hitler listened to the broadcast from Innsbruck, then pounded the table with his fist and exclaimed, "It's got to be done, and done now!" Quote, unquote. A month later, he announced, quote, When Herr Schussnigg breached the agreement on March 9th, at that moment, I felt that the call of Providence had come. Unquote. Toward midnight, Hitler mustered his principal henchmen Goering, Goebbels, and Bormann at the Chancellery and told them that by calling his, quote, stupid and crass plebiscite, unquote, Schussnigg was trying to outsmart them. He proposed, therefore, to force his own solution on Austria now. Goebbels suggested they send 1,000 planes to drop leaflets over Austria and then, quote, actively intervene, unquote. Ribbentrop's private secretary Reinhard Spitzi was rushed to London with a letter asking the new Nazi foreign minister to assess immediately what Britain's probable reaction would be. Hitler sat up with Goebbels and the others until 5 a.m. plotting. Quote, he believes the hour has come, unquote, recorded Goebbels. Quote, just wants to sleep on it. Says that Italy and Britain won't do anything, unquote. The main worry was Austria's powerful neighbors and friends. Hitler took great pains drafting a letter the next day to Mussolini, begging his approval. The complete text found 7 years later in Goering's desk shows Hitler not only justifying his entry into Austria, but also making plain that his next move would be against Czechoslovakia. In his diary, Alfred Jodl was to note, quote, Italy is the most ticklish problem. If she does not act against us, then the others won't either. Unquote. By 10 a.m. on March 10th, when Keitel was summoned to the Chancellery, Hitler had provisionally decided to invade Austria 2 days later. Quote, there's always been something about March, wrote a jubilant Goebbels. It has been the Führer's lucky month so far. Unquote. Neurath, well pleased to have Hitler's ear again in Ribbentrop's absence, also advised a rapid grab at Austria. Keitel sent a messenger to the Wehrmacht headquarters to fetch their operation plans. Despite Blomberg's explicit directive of June 1937, however, there were none, except for Otto. Keitel, meanwhile, went to fetch General Beck and asked him what plans the general staff had made for invading Austria. Beck gasped, quote, unquote, none at all. He repeated this to Hitler when they got back to the Chancellery. The most he could mobilize would be 2 corps. Beck primly declaimed, quote, I cannot take any responsibility for an invasion of Austria, unquote. Hitler retorted, quote, you don't have to. If you stall over this, I'll have the invasion carried out by my SS. They will march in with bands playing. Is that what the army wants? Unquote. Beck bitterly reflected, in a letter to Hossbach in October, that this was his first and last military conference with Hitler, and it had lasted just 5 minutes. The Luftwaffe raised none of these obstacles. Goering immediately made 300 aircraft available for propaganda flights. Diplomatic officials also moved fast, as Wiesacker's diary shows. Quote, 6:30 p.m., hear from Neurath that we're to invade on March 12th. Above all, I insist that we rig internal events in Austria in such a way that we are requested from there to come in, to get off on the right foot historically. It seems a new idea to Neurath, but he'll implant it in the Reich Chancellery. End quote. At about 8 p.m., the Austrian Nazi Odilo Glubochnik, of whom more later, arrived at the Chancellery. He convinced Neurath to suggest to Hitler that Seyss-Inquart should telegraph an quote-unquote appeal for German intervention to Berlin. Hitler, Goering, and Goebbels drafted a suitable text. The telegram, which Seyss-Inquart never even saw, appealed to Hitler to send in troops to restore order because of unrest, murder, and bloodshed in Vienna. Over dinner in his villa, Goering handed the draft telegram to Austrian General Gleisa Horstenau to take back to Vienna. Hitler had already given the general a veiled ultimatum for Seyss-Inquart to hand to Schussnigg himself. At 2 a.m., he issued the directive for the Wehrmacht operation, quote, to restore constitutional conditions, unquote, in Austria. Quote, I myself will take charge of the whole operation, end quote. Evidently, Hitler did not sleep much that night. When Reinhard Spitzi flew back from London, arriving at 4 a.m., Hitler had himself telephoned him using a code name the evening before. Hitler offered him breakfast and read Ribbentrop's verdict on Britain's likely response to the invasion. Quote, "I am basically convinced," the minister had written, "that for the present, Britain won't start anything against us, but will act to reassure the other powers." Unquote. That morning, March 11th, Goebbels's chief propagandist, Alfred Ingmar Berndt, confidentially briefed Berlin press representatives. Quote, "Rather more emphasis is to be put on the events in Austria today. The tabloid newspapers are to make headlines of them. The political journals are to be run about two columns. You are to avoid too much uniformity." Unquote. Brauchitsch conferred at the Chancellery for most of the day. When General Heinz Guderian asked if he could deck out his tanks with flags and flowers to emphasize the quote-unquote peaceful nature of their operation, Hitler agreed wholeheartedly. The telephone lines between Berlin and Vienna buzzed with all the plotting. A failure at the Chancellery telephone exchange even obliged Hitler and Goering to conduct their conversations from a phone booth in the conservatory. Hitler's special agent Wilhelm Kepler was keeping a weather eye on Seyss-Inquart in Vienna now, to ensure that this vacillating and over-legalistic Nazi minister did just as the Führer told him. For several hours beyond the deadline set by Hitler in his ultimatum, Schuschnigg procrastinated. From the phone booth, Goering's voice could be heard shouting orders to his agents in Vienna. Goering's task was to ensure that Schuschnigg resigned before nightfall. Schuschnigg did at last postpone the plebiscite, but after discussing this with Hitler, Goering phoned Seyss-Inquart to say that Führer wanted clear information by 5:30 p.m. as to whether or not President Miklas had invited Seyss-Inquart to form the new cabinet. Seyss-Inquart expressed the pious hope that Austria would remain independent, even if National Socialist in character. Goering gave him a non-committal reply. 5:30 came and went. Goering ordered Seyss-Inquart and the military attaché, General Wolfgang Muff, to visit the president. Quote, "Tell him we are not joking. If Miklas hasn't grasped that in 4 hours, then tell him he's got 4 minutes to grasp it now." Unquote. To this, Seyss-Inquart weakly replied, quote, "Oh, well." End quote. At 8 p.m., he again came on the phone from Vienna. Nobody had resigned, and the Schuschnigg government had merely, quote-unquote, withdrawn, leaving events in limbo. For half an hour, there was agitated discussion in the Chancellery of this irregular position, with Goering in favor now of military intervention, and Hitler a passive, pensive listener. Then, as they slouched back from the phone booth to the conference room, Hitler slapped his thigh, looked up, and announced,
Jetzt geht's los, voran,
which means, okay, we'll do it now, move, end quote. At about 8:30 p.m., Hitler signed the executive order. The invasion would commence the next morning. Soon afterward, at 8:48 p.m., Kepler telephoned from Vienna, that Miklas had dissolved the government and ordered the Austrian army not to resist. By 10 p.m., the all-important telegram signed, quote-unquote, Seyss-Inquart, had also arrived, appealing on behalf of the provisional Austrian government for German troops to restore order. By 10:30 p.m., Hitler also knew that even Mussolini would look benignly on a German occupation of Austria. Hitler hysterically besought his special emissary in Rome over the phone. Quote, "Tell Mussolini I shall never forget him for this. Never, 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 come what may." And, "Once this Austrian affair is over and done with, I am willing to go through thick and thin with him." End quote. As he replaced the telephone, Hitler confessed to Goering that this was the happiest day of his life. For the first time in over a decade, he could return to his native Austria and visit the grave of his parents at Leonding. Hitler told his adjutant Bruckner to ensure that Ribbentrop stayed on in London as a quote-unquote lightning rod for at least 2 or 3 more days. He himself would be in Vienna, if all went well, when he next saw Ribbentrop. Neurath blanched when he heard this and begged Hitler not to risk Vienna yet. Braunau, his birthplace, perhaps not Vienna. Hitler insisted and ordered absolute secrecy. For the first time in 2 days, he retired. Neither he nor Keitel, however, was allowed much slumber, as apprehensive generals and diplomats telephoned frantic appeals to him to call off the operation, quote, before blood flowed, unquote. Braukitsch and Beck repeatedly phoned Keitel and Wiesacker that night, begging them to intervene. The OKW chief of operations, General Max von Wiebahn, bombarded Keitel with phone calls, and at 2 a.m., Wiebahn willingly connected General Muff, the military attaché, to Hitler's bedside phone. Wiebahn suffered a nervous breakdown the next morning and barricaded himself into an office at the War Ministry, where he hurled ink bottles at the door, like some military Martin Luther. Jodl succeeded him. Once again, it was a Saturday, 6 a.m., that day, March 12th. Hitler departed from Berlin by plane. At the Munich operations post of General Feder von Bock, he was briefed on the operation so far. Wildly cheering crowds had greeted the German quote-unquote invaders. Austrian troops and veterans of the World War were lining the highways, saluting and proudly displaying the long-forgotten medals on their breasts. Czechoslovakia did not bestir herself. Indeed, as Hitler sardonically commented to the profusely weeping general seated beside him, Franz Halder, Czechoslovakia seemed suddenly very anxious to oblige him. He crossed the frontier near Braunau at about 4 o'clock and drove on, standing erect in the front of his open Mercedes, saluting or waving as his driver Eric Kempe changed down through the gears to avoid running down the hysterical crowds pressing into their path. It was dusk by the time they reached Linz, packed with a million clamoring Austrians. From the city hall's balcony, he spoke to the crowds, quote, if Providence once sent me out from this fine city and called upon me to lead the Reich, then surely it must have had some mission in mind for me. And that can only have been one mission, to return my beloved native country to the German Reich, unquote. On the following afternoon, he drove out to Landing, where his parents lay, and still lie, buried. By the time he returned to his hotel, an idea which had occurred to him during the night had taken a more definite shape. Originally, he had envisaged an autonomous Austria under his own elected presidency, but could he not now afford to proclaim Austria's outright union with the Reich, i.e. the Anschluss? The Austrian public obviously supported him overwhelmingly. He sent a messenger by air to Goering, asking his opinion, and he telephoned Kepler in Vienna to ask Seyss-Inquart to put the idea to his cabinet at once. When these latter two arrived that evening, they confirmed that the Austrian cabinet agreed to the Anschluss with the Reich. This was Hitler's decision taken. Quote, there is but one moment when the goddess of fortune wafts by, he reminded his adjutants, and if you don't grab her by the hem, you won't get a second chance. End quote. We need not follow Hitler's triumphal progress the next day onward to Vienna. Cardinal Theodor Innitzer, Archbishop of that city, had telephoned him seeking permission to ring all the church bells in Austria to welcome him, and he asked for swastika banners to decorate the steeples as Hitler drove into the capital. At 2 p.m. on March 15th, he took the salute at a great military parade at the Maria Theresa Monument. Wehrmacht troops marched past together with Austrian regiments, garlanded alike with flowers and flags. 1,000 bombers and fighters of the two air forces, led by one German and one Austrian officer, thundered over the capital's rooftops. Baron von Wiesacker, who had arrived with Ribbentrop, wrote that day, quote, which of us does not recall that oft-repeated question of earlier years? What did our World War sacrifices avail us? Unquote. Here was the answer. The whole city was wild with frenetic acclaim. They were seeing the rebirth of German greatness, of a nation defeated despite bloody self-sacrifice, dismembered in armistice, humiliated, crippled by international debt, and yet once again arising in the heart of Europe, a nation united by one of their humblest children, a leader promising them an era of greatness and prosperity. As darkness fell upon Vienna, now a mere provincial capital, Hitler fastened himself into the seat of his Junkers plane, sitting left of the aisle. They flew toward the sunset, the craggy alpine skyline tinged with ever-changing hues of scarlet and gold. General Keitel was looking out over Bohemia and Moravia to his right. With tears in his eyes, Hitler called his attention to Austria on his side of the plain. Quote, "All that is now German again," unquote. After a while, he leaned across the gangway again. Keitel's adjutant sitting behind them saw Hitler show a crumpled newspaper clipping that he had been clutching ever since leaving Vienna. It was a sketch of the map. It was a sketch map of the Reich's new frontiers. Czechoslovakia was now enclosed on three sides. Hitler superimposed his left hand on the map so that his forefinger and thumb encompassed Czechoslovakia's frontiers. He winked broadly at the OKW general and slowly pinched finger and thumb together.